This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, help language spin straw into gold, but with some very punishing conditions attached. Today's show is the annual bonus episode. The people who appear on The Allusionist often tell me things that aren't necessarily related to that episode's topic, but I think, ah, that was interesting, stash it away for the annual bonus episode, which is now. But it's not a typical Allusionist episode, so if this is your first time listening to the show, hello. Do have a go on some of the other episodes as well. We started the year at the Ripped Bodice Romance Bookstore and ended it at the San Francisco Dickens Fair. We went to the Lollapuzzoola Crossword Tournament and the Ancient Roman Baths at Bath. Trans listeners talked about the complicated relationship between language and their bodies. We learnt what it's like to have no words when Lauren Marks had a stroke and lost all her language. And we learned about having all the words when lexicographer Corey Stamper let us in on the inner workings of dictionaries. And a dozen yoga instructors wrote to me asking, "What am I supposed to say at the end of classes now you've ruined Namaste for me?" I have learnt an awful lot this year, and I'm really grateful that you joined me for it. Now, let's hear some bonus bits. In episode 69, historian Greg Jenner checked the Dickensianness of the things that Katie Mingle and Avery Trufelman saw when they visited the Dickens Christmas Fair, such as roller skates.
Those skates are crazy. They're like attached to your calf. They're like little tiny bicycles attached to your calf.
Right. Well, that is delightful.
I mean, they are not particularly Dickensian in terms of appearing in his novels, but they had been invented in the 18th century by a Belgian fella called, I think, John Joseph Merlin, if memory serves, who famously used to ride around on his roller skates while playing a violin and then accidentally managed to smash into a very large mirror while trying to perform this trick.
Haven't we all? On episode 60, Stephen Chrysomalis told us about indefinite hyperbolic numbers, such as squillions, bajillions and zillions. Some people have the theory that the word zillions came about through a process known as zazification.
I should say that I don't really believe in this theory of zazification. So zazification is the idea that if you are going to create a word through replacing one consonant by another, that Z is actually a really nice consonant to use when you're forming English slang words. So this is given sometimes as the origin of zillion. In other words, it's just it's not random. It's that this consonant is actually the one that's desirable when you create slang.
As the possessor of a surname with Z's in it, and it was very sweet of you to translate Z to Z for me.
I'm Canadian, so I probably did it without thinking.
Because I have these Z's in my surname, even if I spell it out to people, they will either change the Z's to an S or leave them out as if they don't believe me that the name has Z's in it. So maybe it's just that's kind of an exotic letter that makes things seem a little bit out of the ordinary.
Well, it is obviously a rare letter in English. Do they replace both of them with S's or just the second one?
Both. The first one is more likely to be replaced and the second one is more likely to be left out, probably.
Oh.
Yeah.
As someone burdened with the long, complicated name of Chrysomalis, you have my sympathies.
In episode 64, Technobabble, Katie Mack explained the Big Bang and black holes and dark matter.
So my name is Katie Mack, and I'm a theoretical astrophysicist. I study the end of the universe.
And how's the end of the universe looking so far?
It's looking really fun.
Can't wait. Here's one way the universe might end if you want something to look forward to. The Big Crunch.
So the Big Crunch is like this hypothetical end of universe scenario. So the universe is expanding now. And back in the 90s, there was this big question of whether the expansion would continue forever or whether it would turn around and everything would come back and sort of condense together. And the term for that is a big crunch. So there was the Big Bang, where everything sort of expands out. And then the big crunch is it all comes back together and becomes hot and dense again and destroys the universe that way. So that's probably not going to happen. Which is nice. Because, I mean, can you imagine, like, how upsetting that would be if we did these measurements and we were like, the expansion of the universe stopped and it's turning around and all these galaxies are rushing toward us now. Like, that would be unsettling.
Yeah, although when you say rushing, does that mean in time inconceivable to the average human imagination?
Well, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it would be, you know, billions and billions of years in the future. But even so, I don't know. I would, just knowing that the universe had like an end date where everything would come crashing together, I think I would find that upsetting in some sort of existential way.
Oh, I find that kind of reassuring. I like being reminded of how insignificant I am.
Well, I mean, there's other ways for the universe to end that also have kind of a time limit, but they're a little bit, well, they're not always gentler. There's one called the Big Rip, which is pretty bad.
Wow, it sounds bad.
Yeah, so the Big Rip would be this kind of thing where, you know, the universe is expanding, right? And the thing that's making the universe expand faster and faster is called dark energy. And we don't know what it is, but we call it dark energy. And if dark energy has, like, this weird sort of pathological property, then it could make the universe expand so fast that first, like, galaxies would rip themselves apart, and then, like, solar systems would come unbound, and then, like, planets would rip themselves apart, and then, like, even atoms, and eventually the whole universe would just tear asunder. And that's known as the Big Rip, and that would be really interesting, but it seems like it's probably not going to happen. But we don't know. I mean, within the you know, errors of the measurements, it's possible. It's just theoretically, it's not one of these things that works really well with the theory. But the observations, that's perfectly consistent. But it would be like trillions and trillions of years, like really long time from now.
Nothing to stay awake over if you're listening to this.
Yeah, yeah.
Are all of these theories for the end of the universe called Big Something? Are they all analogs for Big Bang?
No. There's one called the heat death, although sometimes that's called the big freeze.
Heat death and the big freeze sound like they're the opposite thing.
Yeah, that one, the heat death is a weird term. What the heat death means is that the universe is expanding and it just keeps expanding forever so much that, like, eventually all the galaxies are so far apart from each other that, you know, they can't really see each other. And then the stars, when they just naturally die, don't get any, like, more fuel from other galaxies. And so they can't make new stars. And then everything sort of burns out. And then eventually, like, even black holes will start to evaporate and protons will decay, and the universe is just sort of cold and dark and dead. And it's called the heat death because it's about the universe returning, like the universe going to like this maximum entropy state. So entropy and heat are related, and so it's just about this, like, you just have no more energy to make anything happen, and so everything just kind of stops happening. And the universe becomes extremely cold and dark and lonely. And that one's pretty depressing, too, to be honest.
It sounds like you're describing depression.
I mean, there's not really a, like, pleasant way to end the universe. But I feel like some of them are sort of more upsetting than others. So I always worry a little bit when I give a talk and there are children in the audience and I have to talk about the heat death. I try to like say it gently and not make it too dramatic.
Yeah. The term heat death is quite dramatic though.
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
Also on the Technobabble episode, we heard from Manan Arya.
My name is Manan Arya. I'm a technologist at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California. Unofficially, my title is Space Origami Artist.
What?
I come up with ways of folding very large spacecraft into small spaces so they can be launched into space. And then once they get there, they can unfold into their desired configuration.
Did you do a lot of paper origami to get to that stage?
No, I was interested in spacecraft to begin with, and then I realized there was this sort of rich vein of origami mathematics that people had developed but not really brought to bear in terms of applying them to spacecraft structures. And then I got interested in origami. So It's been fun. If I were to turn this camera around, you'd see just like my desk is littered with folded bits of paper.
Oh, pretty cool. What's the most ambitious paper origami thing you've done to date?
To date?
Yeah.
I folded a 6-foot tall origami crane.
Wow.
That was incredible.
What is the area of the piece of paper as it starts out?
that was I think a 9-foot by 9-foot piece of paper.
Where'd you get that?
That was so photography backdrop. So you know those giant rolls of paper you find for photography.
Ingenious.
I was friends with a photographer who was getting rid of this roll of paper, and I was like, "All right, I'll take that off you." It took multiple people to fold that. It was amazing.
Where do you keep it?
Oh, we ended up burning that because we had no place to store it, and we. I mean, it's the only way to get rid of it because you can't chuck it in a dumpster. That's not befitting of it, you know?
You could dump it just in someone's driveway and they'd have this lovely surprise.
We did plan on leaving it around the Caltech campus and just, have people discover it. But it had a hard time staying upright because structurally it wasn't good enough, which is somewhat ironic given that I'm a structural engineer and I can... But that was over the course of one night, so that we didn't have too much time to mess around with putting an armature or a frame around it or something like that.
And also, is that against the principles of origami, having structural support?
Yes, yes. So the rules of origami, there's three of them. One is kind of flexible. The first rule is it has to be a square piece of paper. People often work around that. The second one is you can't cut. And the third one is you can't glue. Which mathematically turns into a very interesting set of rules because it means you have to preserve, you have to do what are basically called isometric maps. You have to preserve the lengths of on the sheet of paper from one to one form to the next. And so topologists find this interesting. I'm not a topologist.
In episode 59, Caetano Galindo talked to us from Brazil about his work as a literary translator of authors including James Joyce, David Foster Wallace, Charles Darwin, and T.S. Eliot.
Because some of the stuff you've translated is quite old,
yeah.
What do you do when there are words that they've used that are now very problematic words? So they might be racist terms or something like that. Do you choose a comparable term in the other language, or do you go for one that does not have those connotations?
You know, there's quite a bit of editing when you translate, because you have to make all sorts of choices that would could help to ensure a brighter future for the book in your country, to your readers. And that happens not only with problematic words, especially because problematic words tend to happen in different contexts. For instance, my brother, who's also a literary translator, was working with The Sellout by Paul Beatty. The translation is ready now, and he had a problem because we don't have the same problems with racial terms in Brazil. We have different problems, but we have different taboos, different kinds of stigma with certain words. So he had to sometimes invent an offensive language because there is no such thing. So clearly as there is in the United States. So yeah, sometimes you can tone down some offensiveness in the original, and you can do it without violating any sort of integrity. Because this kind of, let me say it with digital quotation marks in here, this kind of adaptation happens all the time in translation, not only when there is a cultural or a racial or a gender problem, because you have to do it all the time. Most of the time when you work with classical literature, as you mentioned, the texts are really old, and you have to face the dilemma that you cannot write some sort of a pastiche of old Portuguese to make it sound like the original would have sounded in, say, 1850. But you cannot write it in contemporary Brazilian Portuguese. You have to find this middle-of-the-road solution. And this involves some sort of editing. And this involves the possibility of making choices that sometimes will tone down some things, some strangeness, some friction, and some offensiveness in the text. And you can do it without sacrificing what I would call the integrity of the original and the translation. That's one of the marvels of literary translation. Because as I always tell my students, for instance, you cannot deny that when I, in Brazil, read a Brazilian translation of War and Peace, for instance, I am reading a text that was made for me in a way that the Russian contemporary reader cannot do with the original. The original is forever locked in the past as a classic. And translations keep making the texts alive again and make them breathe differently. And that comes in all shapes and sizes.
Episode 54, The Authority, featured lexicographer Corey Stamper, who has worked at the Merriam-Webster Dictionary for 2 decades. That job involves tracking how words change in meaning and use, which inevitably they do. But a lot of people think that language is fixed and should not change. And I was curious to know why she thought so many people are resistant to the idea that language evolves.
Our language is our identity. And we code switch between different types of language to suit the situation, to suit the context. And that's hard enough as it is. And I think when we say that language is changing, people panic and think, if it's changing, it must be degrading, because that's all they ever hear, right? No one ever hears language is changing, and that's wonderful. They hear language is changing, and the English is going to fall all to hell. It's just going to fall all to hell. We're all going to speak Klingon or something. So people assume that language change equals language degradation, when of course that's not the case. It's not wrong. It's just different. But I also think language change is, when language changes and you're on the outside of that change, it feels very othering. It feels very like you're being left behind in some ways. And so I think, you know, I certainly find, even with all my training, as I get older, when my children say certain things, like my kids will use the word verse as a verb. So instead of saying, "It's our team versus their team," they will say, "Our team versed their team."
And it's quite sensible.
It is very sensible. But, you know, it's something I didn't do as a kid. So therefore, it must be wrong, right? That's how, like, that's where we immediately go. That I didn't learn that. That's not right. So even with all my training, I still have to buck against feeling like, wait a minute. We have this all taken care of already. You don't need to create the verb verse. You don't need that. And so I think we panic. We don't like change. And I think we feel like it's just too much to keep up with too. I mean, we all know, right? Like, language is so huge, and the idea of all parts of language changing in very subtle ways all the time. I mean, I can barely keep up with my laundry. Like, how am I supposed to keep up with language change?
I don't know, listeners. Let's stick together, and we're just going to do our best. Where language goes, we will go. Well, that's it for The Allusionist in 2017. Thanks so much for listening. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is zoolatry. Noun, rare, the worship of animals. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. Martin Austwick makes the music. If you enjoyed it, you can hear those tunes with lyrics. He has a new album out at palebirdmusic.com. It's pay what you want, so a very low-risk musical acquisition. Thanks to everybody who contributed their knowledge to the show this year, and to the staff at PRX who work so hard behind the scenes to keep the shows of Radiotopia going. Let's convene online, find Allusionist Show on Facebook and Twitter, and pay a home visit to theallusionist.org.